think what was said and done during that interval was regrettable on both sides. Obviously, Quinton got quite personal and provoked an emotional response from Davey. And yeah, I think those things are not on from both sides. You know, getting personal on the field's not on, and that's crossing the line in my opinion.
Hello and welcome to Cricket Unfiltered, the News Corp cricket podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Mensel, a.k.a. Menners, and it has taken just one test for it all to kick off in South Africa. So on this week's edition of the show, I'm going to be speaking to News Corp's intrepid cricket reporter, Ben Horn, who is over in Durban. So I'm going to get all the reaction and fallout from the first test and the Dave Warner and Quinton de Kock incident in the stairwell as they came off the field on the fourth afternoon. Then after speaking to Ben Horn, I have a very special guest joining me. I was lucky enough to speak to one of the stars from the Australian women's cricket team, Elise Perry, before she headed off to India for the one-day series over there. All right, now let's head straight to South Africa and I have on the line Ben Horn, the ace cricket reporter from News Corp. Ben, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks, man. It's a lot of drama going on over here, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's just so much off-field stuff drama before we get on to the actual brilliant result of the first test from Australia, who've gone 1-0 up in the series. I guess, can you just update the listeners on what's happened, I guess, overnight Australian time, I believe? David Warner and Quinton de Kock have both been charged for their involvement in the stairwell incident?
Yeah, that's right. They've both been charged. David Warner with a grade 2 contrary conduct, and Quinton de Kock with a grade 1. So David Warner with a grade 2 could potentially be suspended, but my understanding is he won't be. You can get 3 or 4 demerit points for a grade 2, and my understanding is he's 3. So that means he would escape suspension, but obviously be then walking the tightrope for not only the rest of this series, but the next 2 years. Any kind of minor disciplinary matter could see him suspended for a match. So, but I suppose the good news for Australia is he is set to play the second test. Quinton de Kock is in no danger of missing this test, but I guess if he accepts the charge, we'll have a demerit point or so against his name. But the interesting thing to play out here, man, is both teams have until tomorrow, which is later today, Australian time, but Wednesday, local time, to respond to the charges. If both sides accept the sanctions, then a line will be put through the matter. But there is that possibility that South Africa could still appeal de Kock's charge. That would seem illogical based on some of the evidence that's been presented. But we did have a situation last time South Africa were in Australia that they fought tooth and nail for FAF CCC to get off a suspension,
despite being caught red-handed. I guess one figure that could be a central figure is the Australian wicketkeeper Tim Payne, who, from my understanding, heard sort of what was said between de Kock and Warner.
Yeah, Tim Payne has spoken to us today and basically talked through a couple of scenarios, one being that he was in the stairwell and heard the comment that was made. So he's basically defended Warner for, you know, at least can understand why Warner reacted the way he did and was basically between the two when it happened. So who knows what would have happened in the confrontation if Tim Payne had physically been there between them. I guess the main thing he was saying, though, was, you know, he was voicing Australia's denials at suggestions out of the South African camp that Warner had been abusive to de Kock about members of his family, his sister and his mother. Those suggestions haven't been put on the record by South Africa, but reportedly have sort of come from within the camp. And Payne has come out and staunchly denied that that's the case and said that there was no personal abuse of de Kock during the day. It's become a bit of a he said, she said situation, but the one thing that does support the Australians' viewpoint on this is that the umpires seem to be supporting the Australians on that count, in that they didn't hear anything untoward during the day's play or anything that they felt warranted them jumping in. And they're actually quite upset that South Africa has insinuated that the umpire should have done more to nip the issue in the bud before it blew up at the tea break. So, as I said, it's a bit of to and fro, but the Australians very strong in denying that they had sledged de Kock about his mother and sister.
Yeah, my understanding is that the South African management actually spoke to the media over there before or after a press conference to give that information about the sledging. And I don't know if you're aware, but some footage came out sort of late night here of David Warner saying to Quinton de Kock that he was being a bit of an effing sook as they came off the field. So before that incident in the stairwell. So I guess Warner was caught sledging him, but he certainly didn't say anything about his family. And, you know, I'm sure, well, I've been caught a lot worse than an effing sook. I'm sure everyone has. It's pretty pretty tame comparative to what's been alleged. All right, I want to ask you just...
Yeah, although I would say that, you know, like, the Australians push the boundaries with their sledging. There's no doubt about that. And although I can't condone, you know, what's bringing someone's wife into proceedings, there are a lot of people out there that do, in a way, sympathise with the South African point of view that, you know, the sledging is relentless and forces a response. So it certainly didn't warrant the kind of response that de Kock made, but there's no doubt that the sledging from the Australians was continuous through the day. But the fact that they have the umpire's support on that front is interesting and somewhat significant, because South Africa have painted a different picture that things were out of control before that tea break and the umpires should have intervened.
I can only imagine now that relations between the two teams must be at an all-time low. Might be a bit of a stretch considering it's been pretty bad in the past, but this is as bad as it gets between the two countries.
I would say so, yes. I mean, there's been, you know, a few of these low points over the last couple of series, although the Australian team weren't actually really involved in the whole Faf du Plessis Mintgate situation we had last time around. That was more of a sort of Faf versus the Australian media. But in 2014, there was that drama where Faf called the Australians a pack of dogs for the way that they were sledging in that match. But this is on a whole other level. I mean, not only do you have allegations that people's wives and family members have had disparaging comments made about them, but you have the two sides essentially calling the other side liars. I mean, the Australian team could not be any more emphatic that nothing of a personal nature was said to de Kock, and South Africa are presenting the other side of the story. So I think it's quite likely that this will be put to a close tomorrow. The reason I say that is there hasn't been a denial at all from the South African camp that they were personal towards David Warner. They've essentially admitted that, but they have said that it was a two-way street and that David Warner was, was guilty of personal abuse towards de Kock. So if that's their argument, that it was happening on both sides, then it's difficult to understand how they couldn't accept a lesser charge for de Kock than what Warner's received. So my understanding is that Australia will accept the charges levelled against David Warner. They'll accept the fact that he'll be fined and have 3 demerit points against his name. The question mark, though, is whether South Africa will cop that on the chin. That's what we're all waiting for. I can't see how they fight it, but funnier things have happened.
Yeah, have you heard any whispers about how this CCTV footage got out?
Well, I think that it was leaked to a local journalist here who's done an excellent job on this story, and he's a Durban-based journalist. So there's a couple of theories about whether it was the local association, whether it was the South African team. I mean, in many ways, it's irrelevant. I mean, the incident happened and both players overstepped the mark in the way they reacted, but it was sort of unacceptable situation all around. So, you know, no doubt the Australians would be upset that that's got out, but their powers to stop that. And, you know, I think that's sort of beside the point in a way. You know, it was great. It was great journalism to get that out there. And, you know, these things tend to happen, I suppose, when you're playing overseas and there's an axe to grind. I mean, there's certainly, you would think, whoever has leaked it has decided that this wouldn't look good for David Warner. That's probably fair to say.
Yeah, and I just think if you package that with the insistence that the cricket, the people that cover the cricket in South Africa won't turn the stump mics down despite ICC regulations, I think they're really trying to put Australia off their game. I mean, they are desperate to win this series. They've never beaten Australia at home since readmission. Many of their players might not be around again to have another crack at the Aussies at home. So they are fighting tooth and nail and using whatever method they can to get under the Australian skin. And it didn't work on the field in the first test, certainly worked off the field.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about the stump mic situation. I mean, I think, you know, I'm really torn. I mean, there's certainly an argument to suggest that stump mics should be left up. I mean, if there's any way of discouraging players from that incessant sledging or sledging that goes over the mark, then over the line, then people would say that leaving the mics up is the way to discourage that. I don't quite agree with that. I don't think it really serves a purpose to have the mics up, but I would say that South Africa over here, this is a common problem. It's not just this has popped up in this series. This is a country where teams, including Australian teams, have had issues with stump microphones before. So there's just a different attitude from the broadcaster over here to that. So I'm not sure it's specific to this exact series. It's just a, you know, this is how things operate over here.
What about Nathan Lyon's charge by the ICC? So he's been fined, 15% of his match fee, lost one demerit point for sort of dropping the ball near or partially on AB de Villiers after that run out of AB de Villiers in South Africa's second innings. A strange one from Lyon. How did you see that incident?
I think the penalty's about right. I think it did warrant a charge. I thought it was a bit disrespectful towards de Villiers, you know, not the world's biggest crime and probably just a spur-of-the-moment thing that, you know, if he could take it back, he would. So I think it warranted a slap on the wrist, and that's what he's got. So, yeah, I didn't think it was sort of respectful of a player who's just been run out, and particularly a player of de Villiers' class. But, you know, Lyon, to his credit, apologised straight afterwards and has accepted the charge. So, look, I think that situation has been well handled, and it doesn't seem as though there's any other on-field matters to come out of this match. There was a couple other contentious issues. Warner, when during that same run-out, Warner was seen on camera to be giving a fair break to Aidan Makarem, who was responsible for the run-out. Kagiso Rabada was warned at the time from the umpires for a send-off he gave to Dave Warner. And there might have been, you know, I think Mitchell Starc might have had a few words to say as well at some point. But all of those things were deemed fine. It was just the Lyon incident that overstepped the mark. And, you know, I've got to say I tend to agree with that summation of the events.
Yeah, I agree too. I thought Lyon's was more sort of stupidity, or, you know, he just seemed so excited with the run out. He was making a beeline towards David Warner to give him a big hug, and he just dropped the ball too close to de Villiers. I don't think he really thought about, oh, I'm going to really rub his nose in this. I think it was sort of a situational thing that had he had his time over, as he probably said to de Villiers, he would have done it differently. Okay, so let's go to the cricket, Ben. I mean, what a fantastic victory by Australia. They beat South Africa by 118 runs in difficult conditions. Some standout performances from many of the players. I want to bring a couple to the surface for this discussion. The first one is Mitch Marsh, who played an absolute blinder in Australia's first innings, making 96. I thought that 96 was so crucial in getting Australia up to that 350, which turned out to be such a good total. And, you know, I will put that 96 way above the two Ashes centuries he scored in his return to the side. I just thought that was a really special innings and signifies that we may have found a real number six.
Yeah, I think it probably was his best performance. I mean, the maiden test hundreds probably hard to go past, particularly because I think Australia was in a reasonably tricky patch against England in that test when he came to the crease. But, you know, this was a fighting knock, and the difference with this one, I suppose, was that he didn't have Steve Smith or his brother up the other end to kind of carry the load. It was Mitchell Marsh doing all the heavy lifting himself. He really led the tail well. And without a shadow of a doubt, if Marsh didn't put that performance together, Australia would have been at least 100 runs short of where they ended up, which was a 350 run first innings would have been more like 250. And, you know, in the end, that's probably the difference in the match. So Mitchell Starc deserved his Man of the Match award, but I think the most important moment in the match was Mitchell Marsh's 96.
Yeah, the South African skipper Faf du Plessis after the test spoke about the contrasting performances of both tails, the fact that Australia was able to wag and add valuable runs, Stark's 35 and Cummins hung with Mitch Marsh for a while, but then Mitchell Starc was just able to blow away South Africa's tail. I mean, that was awesome viewing. What was it like over there?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we've become used to it from Starc. I mean, there's not many bowlers that we've seen over any era that can just devastate a side like that. And really, tail-enders just cannot play Mitchell Starc. He's just too quick, too much variation. Yeah, it's almost too easy for him. So yeah, it was an outstanding performance from Starc, and arguably his knock with the bat was just as crucial as some of the wickets he took, because his quick fire 35 really elevated Australia from a score that was going to be in the 200s to well into the 300s. And just psychologically, that makes a big difference, I think. I mean, if Australia had have only put up a total of, say, 270, 280, it's a kind of a different mindset for South Africa when they come out to bat. So Mitchell Starc had a tremendous all-round game. I suppose if you were to pick one criticism, and it is being quite finicky, but perhaps he could improve with the new ball. We haven't seen him as effective with the new ball, but, you know, have you ever seen a bowler more effective coming back, for his later spells? You know, he really is the master of the old ball.
Absolutely. I thought Nathan Lyon's first over of the Test match, when he came on and dismissed Elgar and Amla in his first over, set the tone for the Australian innings. It obviously changed the momentum, but I thought Nathan Lyon showed a bit of Shane Warne there when he was sort of came on and just changed the complexion of the Test match. So Australia took a match-sealing 189-run lead. Australia made 227 in their second innings to set South Africa a total of over 400. I guess Cameron Bancroft's 53 couldn't have come at a more important time for him.
No, I mean, the way that the match went, presuming Australia had won, I think Bancroft probably would have survived for the next test. But in the end, even his 50-odd was important, because Australia probably didn't quite nail that second inning. A couple of batsmen threw their wickets away, and then batting did get quite difficult in the middle end of the inning. So Bancroft's runs were key. I mean, he hasn't proven himself just yet, I don't think. I think he needs another breakthrough performance to really cement that spot. But what he has done is he's proven, I think, most importantly to himself, that he's up to it, because he was probably starting to think, after so many failures, that perhaps he wasn't cut out for Test cricket. So I think, you know, that innings was classy. It was tough. It was gritty. And, you know, I think he's shown that he is capable of getting it right. He spoke about how it actually took him quite a long time to really understand and get in the groove of Shield cricket. And based on that, I think he's confident anyway that if he gets a sustained crack at Test cricket, that he can get it right. So, look, he's bought himself a bit more time. Probably needs a big score in this series to really silence the knockers, but he's given himself that chance now.
And then South Africa in their second innings were dismissed for 298 to give Australia that 118-run victory. South Africa were 4 for 49 at one stage when Faf was bowled by Pat Cummins, but de Kock and Aidan Markram fought all the way, and probably a few nervous moments for the Aussie skipper. Again, Starc cleaned up the tail, took 4 for 75 with a triple wicket maiden. I thought Tim Payne had a great game. He took that superb catch off Markram off Mitch Marsh, standing up to the stumps in the second innings. A really almost a match-turning catch. It was about the time South Africa were coming back into it. And then if you add into that Payne's first innings knock, where he batted very sensibly on the first afternoon, and his third highlight was probably keeping Warner away from de Kock, he had a pretty good match.
Yeah, he did. And he was brought into the side to for a number of reasons, I suppose. I mean, they wanted more runs from their keeper, but they wanted someone who was consistently sharp behind the stumps and brought a real presence. And you would say that Payne has succeeded on all counts. It was a catch that, you know, a lot of wicketkeepers would have put down, and perhaps, you know, on another occasion, maybe Payne would put down as well. But he's a very accomplished wicketkeeper, and that was, like, you know, it was getting towards being quite a clutch moment in the match. Although they were still 120, 130 runs from pulling off a remarkable win, if South Africa had got through another half an hour, that would have probably seen them to stumps, because we saw the bad light coming in early. That extra half hour would have also got them to pretty close to, you know, only about 100 to win. And they would have come back on day five with a serious, serious shot at pulling off that near world record run chase. So in the end, it looked like a very comprehensive win to Australia. And it was. I mean, in almost every department, they outplayed South Africa. But that partnership was good enough to put South Africa in with a shot. And Payne's catch at the time it came was probably the most critical performance, critical moment he's had in Test cricket.
So a fantastic victory by Australia. Steve Smith's men going 1-0 up in the series in front of about 8 people at the Durban ground. Now the series moves to Port Elizabeth. Ben, what can we expect from the conditions in PE? And I guess Australia won't make any changes, but maybe South Africa might make some changes.
Yeah, you never know. I mean, look, spin is probably going to play a part here. It did last time the two teams played. So, you know, I mean, Keshav Maharaj had a great first test anyway, so I imagine he's probably booked in for the series no matter what the conditions. But South Africa has a slight dilemma about whether Morne Morkel continues in the side. They've got a young fast bowler in Gini who's waiting on the sidelines. The other option might be South Africa change up their number six, perhaps put De Kock back down to six, and then have, you know, the possibility of four fast bowlers. But look, our attention has been sidetracked the last couple of days with this whole fiasco, but I tend to think South Africa will probably name an unchanged team. And if things don't go to plan here, then you could see some changes in Cape Town with the prospect that Dale Steyn could be back for that third test. So I tend to think South Africa will probably give these guys another shot. But, you know, we'll wait and see. Tomorrow there's a main training session for both sides.
I was listening to Kerry O'Keefe talk about the South African team, and he says that his worry is that they have an ageing batting lineup, and he doesn't think they'll be able to sort of lift. What do you think?
Well, that's been an issue for a while. I mean, certainly with Hashim Amla, I think that's a big question mark. He has not looked like making a run against Australia in the last four test matches he's played against them. De Villiers showed in the first innings that he's a class above and didn't get a chance to really face a ball in the second inning. So, and Faf du Plessis missed out, but he's shown enough times that he's very capable against Australia too. So, look, I think there's some fragility in that batting order, probably in a similar way to what there is in the Australian side. I mean, if Warner and Smith don't make runs, there's still a question mark about who's going to get them. Mitchell Marsh and Sean Marsh have answered those questions in the last few test matches. South Africa is probably in a, you know, a slightly more extreme position in that if it's not De Villiers or Faf du Plessis, who's it going to be? But, you know, we saw Aidan Markram, the 23-year-old, show that he's the future. I think the concern with their ageing batting order is more what happens next. I mean, if they all retire at once or at a similar time, and it's going to really put a massive spin in South African cricket. So, you know, I think these players are good enough to do the job in this series, but the question mark for me is when they retire and what kind of impact that will have.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for your excellent analysis, as always. Enjoy South Africa, and we'll catch up soon.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben. Great stuff as usual. And I just want to remind all the listeners that when you get up in the morning and you've missed some of the action from the day's play the night before, you can catch up on all the action on dailytelegraph.com.au or any of the News Corp websites, Herald Sun, Courier Mail, Adelaide Now, Perth Now, all of Ben Horn's reaction and reports are on those websites. All right, now we're going to take a quick break, but when we get back from the break, I will be joined by Elise Perry. Elise is an absolute star for Australia. She has represented the country 186 times across all three formats of the game. She has a test batting average of over 61 and a one-day international average of over 50. She recently made 213 not out in the Women's Ashes day-night test. She's also the youngest player ever to represent Australia in any form of cricket, being just 16 years old when she made her debut way back in 2007. She began as a bowler and has taken 236 wickets for Australia across the three formats. But quite remarkably, Elise is so talented that she's also played for Australia in football or soccer, earning 18 caps. The highlight of that was representing Australia at the 2011 World Cup, where she scored a spectacular goal against Sweden. All right, so we're going to take a quick break and then I will be back with Elise Perry.
Short boundary over there. And that's exactly where she goes. Is it enough? Yes, it is! Elise Perry brings up her 200 in style. Did it actually go all the way? Have you celebrated a little bit earlier? So we are going to double check, and everyone's look as we kind of look in. No, it's four. It's four, and she celebrated. Can you believe it? Put your helmet back on, Elise Perry.
Welcome back to Cricket Unfiltered. Menas here. And joining me, I have one of my very favourite sports people. Sometimes when I get to interview people that I've been a fan of for a long time, it's very exciting. And today I've got someone that used to play for my football team, my cricket teams, the national teams. Welcome to the show, Elise Perry. Hi, Elise. How are you?
Hi, Andrew. Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
It's pretty exciting. I think at one stage you were playing for the Sixers, Sydney FC, the Matildas, the Southern Stars. So I was watching you all the time. How have you gone transitioning from two sports to just playing cricket now?
Yeah, I think a lot's changed over the last couple of years, especially in the women's sporting landscape and around elite professional teams and domestic competitions in this country. And yeah, it's certainly been incredible to be a part of and to see that change and development, not just the last couple of years, but probably the 10 years that I've been involved. And I think a big part of that is the ever-increasing professionalisation of female sports. And from my experience, in particular cricket, I think football's on its way. You know, certainly netball, the AFLW, there's lots of exciting things happening. So, yeah, it was really nice to have those experiences playing two sports at a high level and, you know, two sports that I love playing. But I think as things have progressed and to have the opportunity to be a full-time athlete in cricket has been wonderful, and I've really enjoyed that. And I think, you know, that really is the best thing for both sports, that, you know, they're heading that way and that girls can have a career and you know, being a professional athlete. So, yeah, it's been a big change.
Yeah, I was watching your World Cup goal before I came in against Sweden. I think it was in the World Cup quarterfinals. So you've played in a cricket and a football Women's World Cup. How sort of different are they? Because I can imagine there's a lot more attention on the Women's Football World Cup.
Oh, yeah, I suppose so. I mean, they're obviously, to state the obvious, very different games, I think. They're probably received differently too. When I played in the World Cup in 2011 for football, that was in Germany, which, you know, is probably one of the spiritual homes of football. It's the national sport. They truly love it, and they've got a very, very good women's national team there who have won a lot of titles, including a World Cup. So, yeah, that was a huge tournament. We had some wonderful crowds, the quarterfinal included, where there was 30-odd thousand people there, which was just a wonderful experience. And I suppose they also only come around every 4 years, whereas in cricket we've got the T20 World Cups, which are every 2 years, and also the 50-over World Cup. So they're sort of a little bit more common, occur quite regularly, and we play those World Cups alongside the men in the T20 tournament. Up until this year, they've always been played together, and then the one-day World Cup has got bigger and bigger each time we've played it. So, yeah, different feelings, different parts of the world too. I've played a lot of cricket World Cups in the subcontinent where they're absolutely mad about cricket and they're fanatical, and the way that they cheer at games is really crazy. And then I've played some in different parts like England where, you know, most recently the 50-over World Cup was incredible and, you know, Lords was sold out for the final between England and India, and I think every year they just get bigger.
Yeah, do you get a lot of attention on the subcontinent?
As a team in general, I think you do. Australian cricketers are very well known over there and very well followed. And I think it's always been nice to go over there and have that experience playing in the subcontinent, particularly India. But, you know, places like Sri Lanka and Bangladesh as well. You know, it's amazing how fanatical they are about their cricket and how into it they are. So we've always enjoyed playing there, and we often get quite strong crowds.
Yeah, do you have any twinges when you watch the Matildas play that you'd love to be playing football still, or is cricket really your favourite sport?
Look, as I said before, I just have really enjoyed the opportunity of being a full-time professional athlete with a group of girls. Yeah, I don't really have a favourite sport. I've always loved playing both. I've absolutely feel incredibly fortunate to have had the opportunities that I've had in both sports, and, you know, as we've been discussing, they're both really different. So I don't really have a favourite. I think it's just naturally panned out for me that I've stuck with cricket. You know, I never made a conscious decision to stop playing football. It's just sort of worked out because of how the landscapes have changed. But, oh, look, I always miss putting the boots on and having a kick of the football, and whether that's at training or in a match. But it's particularly hard to feel aggrieved or complain that I'm missing that given what I'm doing.
Oh, of course. I guess, though, that must have been a thrill to score that World Cup goal. I mean, is that sort of scoring a goal in football, it's different to scoring a century or something, because you just have that one big adrenaline rush, isn't it?
Yeah, they're such different games. And to be honest, you know, we lost that quarterfinal, and I probably felt, you know, a few of the moments in that match were you know, because of my mistakes as well. So, yeah, it was nice to score that goal, but at the end of the day, we lost that game, and yeah, we didn't progress. So it's a nice moment to have, but I think, you know, all in all, regardless of what sport you're playing, if you're playing a team sport, you remember and probably cherish the moments where the team's been really successful, you know, like winning World Cups or particular series. So those are the things that stand out in my mind. But yeah, you're right, they're different games. I mean, one lasts for 90 minutes, one can last for 5 days. So you probably approach them a little bit differently.
So you speak about team achievements. It's been a wonderful season for you personally and on a team level. You won your second Belinda Clark medal. You're now the number one ranked one day batsman in the world. You scored a test double 100, retained the Ashes. You captained the Sixers to their second consecutive WBBL title. Has this sort of summer been one of the highlights of your career so far?
Yeah, we've been fortunate to achieve quite a lot. I don't know, I kind of feel probably at the moment whilst I'm playing, most summers or years roll into one, because you've had a particularly successful summer back home on Australian soil, but we also, leading into our summer, lost a semi-final of a World Cup over in England. So you sort of feel like, well, I feel like there's been some ups and downs, but what's been a real highlight and something I think I remember more so away from the field is just the development of the sport. As I said, the Lords final of the World Cup was sold out. That was an incredible atmosphere, and then we came home and played a you know, home Ashes series amongst some of the biggest crowds we've ever had on Australian soil, not to mention the people that watched on the broadcast and the way that was covered in the media and the interest in the game, and that flowed on certainly to the WBBL as well. So from that respect, this summer has just been huge, and it's been so wonderful for the sport, and I think we've seen a lot of new players really come to the fore and make the most of their opportunities, and you know, we've got such a great crop of current female cricketers that are progressing the game, and that's been a real pleasure to be a part of.
Yeah, I noticed when you were doing your press conferences over this summer, you seemed to be really enjoying yourself, laughing a lot, having a great time. I mean, obviously, it's easy when you're being successful, but do you feel you're getting better at enjoying the journey now?
Oh, no, I've always enjoyed the journey. I don't think I've got any better at that. I think, I don't know, I suppose particularly this summer there's a few really embarrassing things that have happened to me on the cricket field, and that's probably translated into into various press conferences afterwards when I get grilled on it. But Oh, no, I've always enjoyed it. I think it's really pertinent in the women's side of the game, and something we actually talk about a lot is that, you know, up until last year or so, everyone played really for the love and the joy of it, because whilst you were remunerated a little bit, everyone was juggling other jobs outside of the sport, or studying at university, or doing other things. So I don't think anyone's really been motivated by anything other than having fun and enjoying the sport and spending time with the people that you do it with. So, yeah, that hasn't changed for me. I suppose maybe you just see a little bit more of it these days.
Maybe a bit more of your personalities coming out in the media.
No, as I said, I don't think I've changed. I think it's probably just that you see more of it. There's been more opportunities, and probably more relevant than anything, as I said, was that I had some really embarrassing things that happened to me on the field this year. So
The double 100, celebrating twice, the catch, but
that just hit me. Yeah, exactly. So
you mentioned before the World Cup semi-final loss against India. How do you go with dealing with losses? I know athletes always sort of you try and put it behind you and move on. How do you go with that process?
I mean, you kind of just got to work through it as it comes, because you probably don't plan for it, because you don't want it to, you don't want to lose, or you don't want to be unsuccessful. So you always pin your hopes and goals and aspirations, and also, you know, the way that you prepare for things, you want to prepare to win. So when it doesn't come off, it's always a bit of a dealing process. You know, in the last couple of years, actually, it's probably been twice some really big disappointments that I haven't been used to in the past, or we haven't been used to in the past as a group, because we won a few T20 World Cups in a row. We'd had success in the last World Cup leading up to last year's one, so we'd kind of experienced a lot of great things at that level. And then we made the World Cup final for the T20 tournament in India on the most recent one, and we lost that to the West Indies. And then, as you mentioned, we lost the semi-final in the 50-over World Cup last year in England. So I think they hit you particularly hard once you've experienced the other side of it. And so dealing with it, it definitely lingers for a while. I know leaving both those tournaments, you know, it gnaws at you a bit. Like you sort of, you know, you get on with life, everyone does. But you wake up in the morning and it'll just
grates at you.
It just pinches you for a bit. Yeah, definitely. And then you get on with the day. And I'm sure everyone derives a little bit of motivation out of losing. And it really highlights where you need to improve too. So that's kind of the positive to it, but it doesn't mean that I don't think you dwell on it for a while. And particularly when you break up as a group after a tournament like that and you're left to your own devices, you kind of just stew on it even more. Yeah.
Yep. Now let's go back to your very first game for Australia. It was all the way back in 2007 against New Zealand. You had a very good debut, took 2 for 37 and scored 19 runs off 20 balls. Do you remember the moment when you were given your Australian cap?
I don't actually remember the particular moment that I was handed my cap, but I do remember the night before being told that I was playing. So I'd kind of come out of nowhere to be on that trip, and pretty much had expectations of carrying the drinks for the whole series and just really enjoying it. I was 16 and it was in year 11 at school, so it was kind of just a few weeks of school that I was looking forward to, and you know, given the players and the team, and you know where that side was at the time too, I was just kind of along for the ride, to be honest, and bowling my heart out in the nets, and then yeah, hopefully mixing the drinks well on game day, and just taking in all that I could. But one of the fast bowlers, Clear Smith at the time, went down with a back injury, and I remember the chair of selectors coming and knocking on my hotel room the afternoon before a match and saying, oh, I'm playing. And I just remember being like, oh my gosh. I'm pretty sure I left our hotel room and went down to a park and did lots of like shadow bowling, where I just pretended I was running in because I had so much energy and I guess
nerves
that I just wanted to go and do something about it. So I remember that really well, and it was obviously a huge thrill to be able to play that game.
So you were 16 at the time, is that what you said? 16
yeah, 17? 16.
So were you on tour with your parents? Or were you by yourself?
No, I just went with the team. We, back in those days, we used to stay in apartments with a couple of other teammates. So I was put in an apartment with Kate Blackwell and Clear Smith at the time. You just immerse yourself in the team environment. Mum and Dad, actually, I don't know if Mum was there. Definitely my dad came up. He was there for my first game. you know, but you didn't really spend any time with them. You're very much just a part of the group on tour and did everything, and that was also my first taste of it too, so I just kind of wanted to be around everyone.
Did you feel that it was a huge learning experience being with all these older women?
I'm sure subconsciously I picked up a lot. I think, you know, that trip was just so much fun, and as I said, I didn't expect to be there. I don't think anyone expected me to be there, so it was just, you know, taking it all in. I think certainly subsequent trips after that, when I was sort of kept getting selected on tours, I really learnt a lot, and I do think it probably helped me mature and grow up a little bit quicker than I probably otherwise would have. You know, especially throughout my high school years, I just felt like I'd had these extra experiences that most kids in high school don't get at that stage. You know, sort of operating in the real world, so to speak, a bit. And, yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was really beneficial for me.
Yeah, and what was it like going back to school and being around your mates? Where did you go to school? In Sydney somewhere?
Yeah, I went to Pymble Ladies College in Sydney. And I absolutely love school. You know, my best friends still are all friends from school, and they were incredibly supportive, and yeah, it just felt like I hadn't really missed anything when I went back, besides the work. I was always pretty far behind on that, but I don't know. I think one of the things I loved about the school that I went to was there was so many girls achieving things in so many areas. You know, it wasn't just sport, it was drama and arts and academics and debating, and you know, we had like the world champion chess player at school, so there was this really great culture of
achievement
and people really striving to do their best. And so yeah, it just felt like I was back a part of the school, and it was really nice to see friends. And I always had, I guess, post-tour blues a bit of not being away and being back at school and having to put a uniform on and all those things. But, it was great.
Yeah, friends have a tendency to bring you back to earth pretty quickly.
Very much so.
What was it like for you growing up in the public eye? Because, I mean, as I said at the beginning of the show, I meant that I've been following you probably since 10 years. You've been one of the most publicised female athletes in the country. I don't know if it's because I'm a massive soccer and cricket fan, but, you know, how was that experience at such a young age?
I've never really viewed it like that, to be honest. I think, you know, relative to the size of the country and the amount of people here and, you know, the fact that there's so many people doing so many different things in different walks of life, so I never really felt like I was in the public eye, so to speak. I suppose, you know, people that you know and who looked out for you and they saw you on TV, they'd kind of mention that and things like that. But, I genuinely just felt like and still do feel like a normal person who just is fortunate to play sport for a living now. But, you know, in the past, just sport because I love it and at a level that I'm fortunate enough to have been able to reach. But I think, as I said before, the one thing that I'm really grateful for is those experiences when I was 16 or 17 and still at school really, I think, helped me mature and get a real grasp on, you know, who it is that I want to be as a person and what I want to get out of life and, you know, the things that are really important to me in terms of my sporting career, but also, you know, I guess, who I am as a person away from the field as well.
Yeah, and were there any negatives to having all that attention or?
I don't think so. To be honest, as I said, I didn't really feel like I had a lot of attention. I just
you just did what you did?
Yeah, I think I've just always loved this environment. I think you're around so many people for a day-to-day life that have achieved a lot and are really motivated and passionate, and I think that rubs off on everyone. So you just want to get on to the next thing. I guess when you have a good game or put in a good performance, you feel a little bit content for that day, and you're really happy with yourself, and you probably go to bed kind of, yeah, chuffed. But you wake up the next morning and there's things that you know, new things that you want to achieve or things you want to work on or, you know, a new challenge ahead of you. So I guess I've just kind of always viewed it like that, and I've never thought I've made it because I always feel like I can be better.
Seemed like you've had a very level head though and managed to sort of keep your focus away from all the external pressures.
I think I'm pretty intrinsically motivated in that sense. Like I derive a lot of motivation from things that I want to achieve, and it's not really about any external kind of motivators, whether that's fame or attention or anything like that. I don't know. I'm a pretty private person. I'm not really interested in that stuff. It's not me. I probably get pretty exhausted being around a big group of people for too long because I'm quite introverted. And yeah, so the things that I guess make me feel satisfied is just when I achieve things that I put my mind to. And I think in large part being a part of a team when you're doing that too makes it even more satisfying, because you've worked with those people closely and you can share that with them, and that's as far as you need to go with it.
And how has then being the captain of the Sydney Sixers been for you? I know last year you injured, you missed the final, but this year you were able to play right through the season, lift the trophy. How was that experience leading a group?
Oh, I've absolutely loved it. I think it's probably been one of the most fulfilling and satisfying things that I've done so far in my career. And every player, I think, when the WBBL started, had a real sense of ownership for the tournament and a real value for it, and wanted to make sure that it was successful, because it really is the showpiece of our game at the moment in Australia, but also around the world. It's easily the preeminent women's cricket competition for a number of reasons. I think the standard and the quality, but also the professionalism of it, the fact that we attract the best players in the world to play in it. So yeah, I've really loved the opportunity to, I guess, use the things that I've learnt over the time that I've been playing, and the things that I think help make a team be successful, and work really closely with our head coach Ben Sawyer and the rest of our support staff, as well as all the players, to, I guess, ingrain that into our team and create a culture that is hopefully successful, and we play a style of cricket that we want to play that's going to hopefully inspire more young girls to play as well.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like the Sixers and the national team is very close. It's a real tight-knit group of players. Is that right? Is it, it seems like a really good, close group.
Some
are closer than others, but
yeah, I think like any environment or workplace, if you want to call it that, there's people that you probably more naturally gel with than others, but certainly in this kind of, in sport, when you're all working so hard to achieve a common goal, you do become really close, and you spend a lot of time together as well, so you get to know each other really well. And I think particular to those two teams you mentioned, the Australian team, the personnel hasn't changed a lot in the last 5 or 6 years, so we really know each other well. We'll go out for a team dinner, and I think I could probably order what everyone's going to have for them, and vice versa.
Do you know
versa.
All the coffees?
Yeah, I know all the coffees. I know who likes fish, who likes chicken, all those things. So, you just get to know each other so well, because you're kind of living out of each other's pockets. And it's probably the same with the Big Bash. It's sort of 6 or 7 weeks of real concentrated and intense time together, and so you get to know each other, and I think you see all the different sides of people, which is actually really important. It's easy to see the best sides of people when you only spend a bit of time with them, but when you're in an environment where you're under pressure and there's scrutiny and you need to perform and do a job, I think you get to know each other really well, and then you probably become really protective of one another, because at times everyone's going to struggle with something.
Yeah. Now looking ahead, I saw you're on Twitter now, finally. What brought that on?
I'm
not
sure.
Was it the PR department? You at least care the PR department?
Yeah, I'm still not sure why I'm on Twitter. I'm getting used to it. But
I saw
I'm
one
on
of
there.
Your answers to a question about your outside interests, that you like public policy. So is this foreshadowing a career in politics?
Absolutely not. I couldn't think of anything worse. I think it's suicidal being a politician. But I think, as I said before, like the last couple of years of my schooling life, when I was traveling around to different places and seeing whole new parts of the world, which I'd never been overseas before I got selected to play for Australia. I didn't have a passport. I think doing that and seeing different cultures and different nations and where they're at in terms of their development, and then always being able to come back to Australia and live in this country where we are so incredibly lucky, and the opportunity that's afforded to all of us as youngsters, obviously on varying levels, but I think across the board it's an incredible place to grow up
compared to India or something.
Exactly.
We have
I still remember my first trip to India was like I was with Elisa Healy, and we kind of looked at each other and were like, we can never complain about anything again. You know, and while you're over there, you just, like, your eyes are so wide and you're looking at this incredible poverty, but the fact that people still, you know, happy and they're smiling and they genuinely look like they're enjoying life, and then you think about the frivolous things that you complain about, you know, back home. You know, if you don't have your favourite kind of food in the fridge,
your
or something like that.
Taking too long at the cafe.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the whole time we were over there, we were just like, oh gosh, like, we're so lucky, can't complain. And then, you know, you get back home and you're home for 2 weeks and you're back into the swing of things, and then you are complaining about stupid things again. So,
so do you want to be involved when you finish cricket in making a difference? Is that...
I probably don't have any definite plans or ideas, but I think one thing that I'd really like to be involved in and push onto young people is to make the most of the opportunities that we've got, and, you know, just go out and do things, because I think, you know, as I said, when you go over to another country and you see, you know, some people are just pigeonholed into a life that they're never going to be able to get out of, and they might have the most amazing talents in the world, but we'll never know. Whereas I think in Australia, you can do whatever you want. You just got to have a good attitude about it and put your hand to it. So I think that's where it's been so incredible to be involved in women's sport in the last little bit, is that these opportunities that are springing up for young girls are just amazing. And, like, I look at the new crop of players coming through, going to be ready to play for Australia 5 or 6 times, and they're going to surpass anything that any of the current players are capable of doing. You know, because, you know, for a few reasons, they're very talented, but they're going to have the most amazing opportunities. So yeah, I think that's really important.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. My daughter just loves seeing the women's cricket teams play. It's real inspiration for her, yeah. More than my son, who hates cricket. The listeners will know that. All right, before I let you go, I've got some rapid-fire ideas about the Women's Big Bash.
Right.
You can just give me some quick answers. I'm going to fire them at you.
Okay.
They're talking about moving the Women's Big Bash to October, November, so it has its own window. I think it's a great idea. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a great idea.
Needs its own airtime. Now, we saw in the opening weekend of the Women's Big Bash, one of your big sixes hit a poor young man in the face.
Yep.
And I've sort of thought on these smaller grounds, they need to look at some kind of netting like they do in baseball to protect the crowd. Do you think as the men and women hit the ball harder, it's something they need to look at?
Yeah, look, it's amazing it hasn't happened more often, to be honest. That's sort of what I thought, you know, when it happened. And fortunately, he was okay, and... yeah, I was able to chat to his dad a few times, and yeah, he's doing well. But yeah, I suppose so. I mean, yeah, you want to make sure that people are coming to the cricket and being safe. But as I said, it doesn't happen that often, so they probably never thought about it before.
I think it'll happen more and more, the more sixes. I mean, we saw 32 sixes in New Zealand.
Unless you put someone with a one of those shirts on, and you can win a competition, and then everyone will be paying attention every
exactly.
ball.
Give out free $50, t-shirts.
$50,000 if you catch a catch.
Yeah,
that's
pretty good.
So.
Yeah, I wish I had a better fielder. What do you think about the multi-format series? Do you think they should play more of them, where they mix formats for men and women?
Oh, it's probably hard for me to speak about the men's side of the game, but I'm a huge proponent for it for the women's side. I think it's worked really well in the Ashes, and it'd be really nice to do that against other top nations in the world. And I'm probably saying that because I've got an invested interest, but I'd love to play more test matches. I think everyone would, and... the way that we've done it in the Ashes, where it's, you know, it's one test, but it's, you know, worth a lot of points. There's a lot of interest in that game. We had a great turnout to North Sydney for that match. So I think it'd be really good to do it against other nations. And it's just going to improve the quality of test cricket then too.
Yeah, I agree. Last two, what about Christmas Day cricket? Do you think that it's something they should look at, or are you against it?
I'm probably against it, only because I think about what I want to do on Christmas Day, and the last thing I'd like to do is watch sport. You just want to spend time with your family and friends, and you know, I guess really enjoy each other's company. So I don't think it's a particularly attractive option. But I'm not the marketing genius. So,
and last question: what about all these girls' cricket leagues propping up?
Yep.
Do you think that's great for the game now that girls can play against each other and build their own competitions?
Yeah, look, I think it's great. I grew up playing boys' cricket. Oh, sorry, I should just say I grew up playing in a co-ed team. I happened to be the only girl in my team, but there was a few other girls in the comp, and I think that was really great for my development. But it's not for everyone. So I think, you know, the fact and it's probably happened in other sports off the top of my head, like soccer's a really great example of all girls competitions being extremely successful. And, you know, I think whatever entices more girls to take up the sport and get involved and then hopefully enjoy it is great. So it's probably nice to have both options. I still think that girls, if they want to play any sport against boys when they're young, they should.
Yeah, well, I agree.
Cool.
Well, Elise, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a thrill to talk to you. Good luck with the rest of the season and in India.
My pleasure, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again for downloading and listening to this week's edition of Cricket Unfiltered. You can find me on Twitter at Amenners, AmeNNERS. You can find my weekly cricket column at dailytelegraph.com.au/cricket. Remember to subscribe and rate the podcast, and we'll be back next week with another episode.